the issue of homelessness. We're investing over $1 billion yet again to address the issue that defines our times. The new numbers that came out are from last year. The new numbers that showed a 16.5% increase, 150 plus thousand people in the state of California, not all living out on the streets and sidewalks, some sheltered, most unsheltered. Those numbers are from last January. Those are the numbers we inherited. Those are the numbers I now hold myself to a high level of accountability to address.
California Governor Gavin Newsom unveiling his more than $220 billion budget. He wants $1 billion of that to go to help the homeless. He also wants California to become the first state to sell its own generic prescription drugs. It's all in keeping with Newsom's ambitious goals as he enters his second year as governor, and something he delivered mixed results on during his first year. Joining us now to recap Newsom's time in office so far and what we can expect going forward is Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you back. All right. Well, let's look back first, and let's look back at Newsom's first year in office. How did his performance stack up to his promises made when he was campaigning?
Well, he made a lot of promises, so it's hard to stack up to all of those. But he did put down a lot of markers in a bunch of issues, so he sort of backed that up. He had more money to spend, and he was more willing to spend it than Jerry Brown was. And I think that was, in a sense, if you want to have the story of the first year, it's that the purse strings got somewhat loosened. Mm-hmm. In a number of areas. He signed many more bills than Jerry Brown would have signed. At the same time, he was kind of prudent in a way that annoyed a number of his supporters because some things he made temporary rather than permanent. And when people found that out, they felt a little bit blindsided. But I also think that was probably an example of some of the fiscal responsibility we remember from the Jerry Brown era. But Jerry Brown made that first year possible by reestablishing the state's fiscal standing in the world, that it was no longer a basket case. And I think Newsom ran with it. I think he's continued to struggle with wanting to do everything and having, you know, numerous number one issues. And I think, you know, that's still in this budget as well. But he certainly can't be faulted for a lack of ambition to get things done.
Yeah. Well, this is a huge budget, $222 plus billion. Plus, it envisions a gigantic surplus and a reserve fund, right? Like $18 billion by 2021?
Yeah, and again, both the voters and Jerry Brown laid the groundwork for the ability to make all these proposals by creating a majority vote for the budget instead of the old two-thirds budget. So the budgets pass much more easily. Mm-hmm. And the reserve fund just keeps growing, and they're talking about a $7 billion surplus. Now, of course, no one is going to argue for spending at all on things, but the argument for not spending has kind of eroded, especially as the Democrats have won more and more seats in the legislature with this kind of mega majority. You couldn't sustain Jerry Brown style with this legislature right now. So he's kind of riding a different kind of wave where people want to get a lot. And people believe there's a lot of money to do a lot of things.
Right. And one of those big things is to help the homeless. He wants to spend $1.5 billion on helping the homeless. He wants to basically give out cash to localities to build more housing and to provide health care and other emergency services. And so, and I guess one of his big promises, right, was to build 500,000 units of housing every year. I guess he hasn't done that in the last year, but he certainly does want to tackle this issue. How has he done on the homelessness front?
Well, he's probably done as well as anybody else. I mean, everybody's struggling with this state, county, city, and even federal to figure out how to solve this. It's awfully hard to build that much housing. He hasn't yet quite taken on the land use situation, which is the most sensitive issue about building more housing. I know the cities would like a lot of this money that he's putting in his budget to go to construction, and not all of it is, but then people have to be able to construct. And they're making state land available for homeless housing, but the question is, will you be able to actually get people into those spots if they're very far from where they are right now? So he's trying, and I think it'll be welcome at the local level, but it, you know, there's a lot of structural issues here that everybody's going to have to wrestle with.
Right. Well, one idea is one that has been made several times so far. This is Senator Scott Wiener's bill. He represents San Francisco. Another push for SB 50. This is the controversial housing density bill. It would build four cities, really force them to build along transit lines. And a lot of neighborhoods are saying, no, we don't like this. Where is Newsom on this?
I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure where he is on this one. I can tell you that it's very controversial at the local level. At the end of the day, the politics of this is local and down to the neighborhood level. And there's often a feeling at the local level that people in Sacramento are great at passing laws, but the mayors and councils have to figure out how to make this actually work. And that's going to be a tough battle ahead. I'm not sure a budget's the place to do that, though, in fairness to the governor.
All right, let's talk about this other plan for California to become the first state in the union to sell its own line of generic prescription drugs. Here's Newsom talking about it today.
We believe we can get in the business of generics. We can brand through California RX, our generic drugs program. We are already in active conversation with some of the major purchasers in this state. And forgive me in advance for not getting the details of the negotiations. One guarantee of this not working is telling you who we're negotiating with. But I can assure you things like insulin are top of mind.
Okay, so why is he doing this?
Well, the whole prescription drug question is a gigantic political issue that has massive public support. I guess one question I had is, did the governor give enough credit to what he did last year, which is pulling the Medi-Cal program into this purchasing collaborative with the state government that now local communities want to buy into as well? That could be a game changer. In other words, that could create an overall purchasing model along the lines that people are talking about letting Medicare negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. So I think that could have more time. I think this new one is a very exciting thing, but it may have a limited effect compared to the big purchasing cooperatives he's been creating. So I guess I wonder a little bit if he stepped on the story he has to tell from last year. It certainly got the most interest. It certainly got the most public attention.
Right.
It may not deliver quite as much as people hope, and there's a whole lot to do to make it happen.
Well, so that, along with this idea to create a consumer protection agency, is really taking aim at the federal government, in particular the White House, right, which has pulled back on this consumer protection agency on the federal level. Newsom has made no secret of the fact that he doesn't like President Trump and he doesn't like his policies. Do you think that Newsom is eyeing larger national office?
Well, sure. I mean, near the end of the presentation, he made a number of kind of comments critical of the president, like referring to ignorance and arrogance. He said Trump doesn't care, California does, that in consumer areas and deficits, he contrasted it. Remember that California is, in a sense, the head of the resistance to the Trump administration, as people kind of popularly call it. I don't know that this presentation, as long and detailed and in the weeds as it was, really created the kind of visibility to make that case. I think that case is in all the materials, but it wasn't brought out because it was a very much kind of a policy wonk speech to sort of policy networks and the legislators.
Yeah.
And Rafe
is still talking, I understand, and he started at 10:30.
I think in the long run, the question he'll be resolving is what's the advantage of knowing all the details and being phenomenal on the details and distilling it to a message that people can say this is what the governor is about. I think he's had that challenge from the start. And I think it's an extreme case of what Mario Cuomo, the famous governor of New York, once said. He said, you campaign in poetry, you govern in prose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think budgets already lend themselves to that. But I found myself distilling the message from it, which, you know, usually would be the speaker's job. He said at one point, we have a public option, talking about health care. That's a rather important point to make, given the whole debate about health care in the Democratic primaries. He several times talked about being the first, California being the first and the best. But at some point, you have to rise above these details to get that case out there. And when it goes on too long, you know, people do have outside the policy networks. At one point, he said, those of you watching at home, and I couldn't quite figure out who those
who
were.
Would those people be? Well, yeah, certainly not like his predecessor, who has made famously short budget
speeches. Well, not only that, and, you know, you can't ever repeat Jerry Brown, but Jerry Brown used to give short speeches that were filled with obscure philosophers that we all had to pretend, you know, we knew who they were. But they were always kind of these apt quotes, some of them from the Old Testament. At the same time, though, he was Jerry Brown, and that's a kind of a unique act to follow. I think that detail is going to be something Newsom's going to be known for, and we just are going to get used to it. But at the same time, what will be his selling point is that the Democratic Party nationally may find, in if you can distill out of all this talk the actual details that are that jump out, this could be the some elements of a national agenda for the Democrats going forward, and that will be significant.
Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Always great to speak with you. Thanks, Rafe.
My pleasure.
Coming up, why Facebook is hurting democracy. A member of the Federal Election Commission is here with her objections to Facebook's decision to allow misleading political ads. That conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, they may say they're political or apolitical, but some Silicon Valley execs are secretly pouring millions into this year's election in an effort to help Democrats. They figured out a way to skirt campaign finance laws, legally, to quickly become one of the most influential groups in this year's election. Teddy Schleifer wrote about its growing influence and unusual strategy in Recode, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great. So this group, it's called Mind the Gap. Who are they?
Right. So Mind the Gap is a group of about 800 Silicon Valley, heavily Silicon Valley-based donors who have long wanted to get involved with American elections. And, you know, for a long time, there's been sort of this organized era during the Trump age of rich people giving money to Democratic candidates, but without any real kind of organization. And what Recode basically has sort of uncovered is that a lot of giving by Silicon Valley over the last 2 years has actually been quite organized. And that, you know, a rich person in Palo Alto who's giving $2,800 to a suburban congressional candidate outside Chicago, that might be organic, but it might also be the result of this group, Mind the Gap.
And what's their general philosophy and goal?
I mean, I think that, like, you know, they, like a lot of Democrats, want to get rid of Trump fervently and will put all their money behind it. But their sort of secret sauce is this willingness to apply sort of this cold, hard math to U.S. politics in a way that lots of rich donors might say they want to do, but they also care a lot about the personality of the candidates or meeting them and having a personal connection. What Mind the Gap has proposed is that there's too much emotion in political fundraising, and that people should give money to candidates that are most likely to lead to the outcomes that Democrats want. So they're trying to take a data-based approach, which listeners should not be surprised to hear resonates pretty well with tech leaders.
So what does that mean exactly? When you apply this approach and you apply the cold, hard math, what does that turn into?
Sure. So I'll give you an example. So basically, in 2018, and during when the midterms came up, lots of Democrats were giving money to candidates who were, you know, who were in toss-up races, right? The idea that you have a race in a certain district, maybe Democrat has a 49% chance of winning, Republican has a 51% chance. Lots of donors would say we should fund the candidates that are most likely to flip a seat. Mind the Gap had a different idea. They funded lots of candidates who were actually likely to lose, but where each additional dollar would have the biggest marginal impact. So they were funding lots of candidates who maybe had, let's say, a one-third chance of winning. And the idea then is, well, maybe they're not that likely to win, but if we give them $2,700, or for some candidates in the aggregate ended up being more like $600,000, this campaign might move from a 33% chance of victory to a 45% chance of victory. And that's a pretty good return on the dollar. while a campaign that already has a 49% chance of winning, you know, maybe the money would move to 49.5 or something like that. So the idea was to fund campaigns that were underfunded, even if they weren't likely to win.
But it is all or nothing when it comes down to it. I mean, you want your candidate to win. So what is their success rate with that formula?
Sure. So about 10 of the 20 candidates they funded in 2018 ended up winning, which on the surface doesn't sound that impressive, but you got to remember that most of these campaigns statistically were not likely to succeed, and lots of these candidates were pretty down on their luck by the time Mind the Gap showed up.
And these are congressional candidates across the country?
Right. So in 2018, they focused on congressional campaigns. But in 2020, what we've sort of uncovered is a product of a different scale. Just to give listeners a sense, in 2018, Mind the Gap directed about $20 million to Democratic candidates and causes. In 2020, they're planning on $140 million investment, up to $140 million, mostly focusing on voter registration efforts, which are not sexy or not frequently in the headlines, but they believe that there are kind of a trio of voter registration groups that they're going to try and raise up to $100 million for to register voters in kind of key battleground states. So if 2018 was the appetizer, this is the entree. This is their big push.
And are they involved in all with Tom Steyer? Because he has also made voter registration a big part of his campaign.
Right, right. There's no link that I'm aware of to Tom Steyer. There are lots of Silicon Valley titans who think that voter registration is the way to go here, rather than focusing on ads or focusing on convincing new voters. The idea is to take the existing demographic, the existing electorate, and just register more of them.
And so is this a group, you write that it's been largely secretive, is this a group that wants to fly under the radar and not be noticed and talked about and read about, and if so, why?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's the whole point of the group. The entire raison d'etre of this group is to be quiet and secretive, so we may have given them a little bit of trouble here. But essentially in 2018, what the group tried to do was to find Democrats that were underfunded and then give them money, but only do it late enough in the campaign cycle that Republicans wouldn't notice, hey, why does, you know, this candidate suddenly have $600,000 from rich people in Silicon Valley? The idea was in 2018 to do this late and to sort of avoid the tit for tat that can happen in congressional politics, where a campaign gets a lot of money from Democrats and the Republicans say, you know, organize their own donors and gotta get their folks to get behind the Republican candidate, which then sort of restores parity and makes a fundraising effort in the first place moot. So what they're trying to do, the entire point of this effort in 2018, and less so, but I think still essentially in 2020, is to be quiet and secretive and stealthy to prevent sort of a tit-for-tat bidding war between Democrats and Republicans in key elections.
Although that does raise suspicions, right? When you hear a group that has a lot of money that wants to be quiet and stealthy and secretive, you think, they're up to no good, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a public service element here in our reporting, which is that Americans should know the forces behind the campaign ads they see and the election results that they think they produce. We believe that folks should be aware of this on both the left and the right. And this is happening, right? Mind the Gap is an organization that has no website. You know, the leaders are not advertising their participation on LinkedIn. There's no social media presence. And to be fair, there are tons of groups on the right that are secretive. Obviously, the most prominent is probably the Koch Network, led by Charles and David Koch, that for years was able to influence American elections with little scrutiny. So here, you know, there's no allegation, of course, that Mind the Gap has done anything illegal. People have the right to give $2,800 to candidates if they would choose to do so. But, there's been little scrutiny, and theoretically, both leaders on the left and the right claim to want to get money out of politics. Here, we at least have it disclosed now.
Teddy Schleifer covers wealth for Recode. Thanks so much.
Sure thing. You bet.
Well, Well, speaking of big tech influencing our politics and our elections, Facebook announced yesterday it will not police whether political ads on its site are true. It also will not limit how political campaigns can use the platform to send ads to certain people. And that has drawn sharp criticism from some members of Congress and from some federal regulators, including Ellen Weintraub. She's a member of the Federal Election Commission, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what are your objections?
Well, I'm concerned that the micro-targeting of political ads creates a situation where individuals are targeted based on the vast amount of information that Facebook is collecting about them. So they get ads that are really, they're micro-targeted. They are designed to move that particular individual, and it doesn't get a wide amount of play. So the normal First Amendment argument about allowing the most amount of speech and encouraging robust debates would indicate that when somebody says something that you don't like, you get out there and give a counter argument and say why it's not right or not true, or there's another point of view that should be considered. That doesn't work if everybody is not seeing the same ads. So you could have one set of ads going to one house in a neighborhood that argues one point of view on an issue and then argues the exact same candidate could send ads arguing that he's going to do the exact opposite to people who are neighbors of that person who, according to Facebook data, it indicates that they would have different points of view. And then the hypocrisy of those ads is not exposed and people don't have the opportunity to point out the inconsistencies or perhaps the lack of truth of those ads. So I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. I don't think that Twitter, who is banning all political ads, is taking the right approach. They've I think, gone too far. But Facebook, Google is banning micro-targeting, and Facebook said they were considering it, but then the policy that they came out with was much, much weaker than that. They claim to have a transparency solution that is neither transparent nor much of a solution.
Hmm. Well, I guess the counterargument would be, at least from the campaign's point of view, is that this is a very effective way of reaching voters that are most likely to support us. And so what's wrong with that? Barack Obama did it. Bernie Sanders did it. Using data and information publicly available to attract the most likely supporters. So I guess what's wrong with that from a looking at democracy angle?
Well, what's wrong with putting your arguments out there where everyone can see them? So to the extent that people want to offer counterarguments, they have the opportunity to do so.
Okay, but do you say Facebook's decision is essentially bad for democracy, like they're actually harming democracy?
Well, I think that Facebook has really had a huge impact. You know, this is a system that was designed not that many years ago in a dorm room to connect college students with each other. And it's now become a global platform with unbelievable reach and power. And I don't think they've really grappled with that. They create this platform which has all these incredibly powerful tools. And then they say, well, what people do with them, that's not our problem. We don't really have to worry about that too much. That's just what people are saying on the platform. But we've seen it become, in some ways, a very positive force, but in other ways, a really negative force. It's been a vector for disinformation. The way their algorithms are formulated, and I'm not an engineer, I don't know about this stuff, but it is pretty obvious that their algorithms are designed to keep people engaged and to some degree to keep them outraged, to keep them on the platform for as long as possible, clicking away, clicking on this, clicking on that. And a lot of what people are clicking on is just not good information. Mm. People can't even tell sometimes where the information is coming from. We know that the Russians used Facebook as a vector for disinformation and for sowing discord in our country, and we should be all concerned about that as citizens.
So you're concerned with the micro-targeting. You're also concerned with whether or not the ads are truthful, right? That Facebook has said, look, we can't be in the business of policing everything that people say on our platform. So we're just not going to do that when it comes to these ads, even though, yeah, we recognize that things may have not gone so swimmingly in the last election, but they're not going to do anything about policing the content of these ads because they don't think that that's, you know, in keeping with the First Amendment. What do you say to that part of it?
Well, I think it's an interesting argument that they're making, because they're not actually holding to that for in other circumstances. They do police the truth of a lot of advertising that goes on their platforms. They've just said that when it comes to politicians, they're going to take a hands-off view. And I think some folks have made some compelling arguments that Facebook itself should not be the ones to be making these determinations. I hear that concern. Nobody wants to be the speech police, right? I don't want to be the speech police. Facebook doesn't want to be the speech police. But they have partnered with fact-checking organizations, neutral, nonpartisan fact-checking organizations in other contexts, in order to provide that extra context to their readers, to the folks who are on the platform, that, hey, some neutral body has said that this information is not true. And that is not a that's something they do for other kinds of ads that are non-political. So I'm not sure why they made the call that when it comes to political ads, those alone should be out there in kind of a non-checking truth-free zone. And again, it's compounded when it's micro-targeted, because you don't have the normal check of somebody else being easily able to see the ad and say, hey, that's just not right.
Well, is there anything you can do as a member of the Federal Election Commission?
Well, unfortunately, right now, the Federal Election Commission does not have a quorum of members to issue regulations. So we literally can't do anything about it right now. If we did have a full quorum of members, then we would have to see whether we could surmount the ideological divides on the commission in order to pass new regulations. There are any number of good bills in Congress, and I appreciate that Facebook has, in fact, even endorsed some of those bills in Congress, but they're bottled up in Congress and unlikely to go anywhere. So Facebook has taken a position here that, well, they say they want regulation, they want legislation to be passed. They know darn well it's not going to happen. So that's kind of an easy way out for them to say, well, we shouldn't be the ones to make these decisions. Somebody else should make the decisions. Oh, they're not going to make the decisions? Well, don't look at us then. Don't blame us for the discord and the disinformation that ends up getting spread around on our platform. I think they've created this incredibly powerful tool, and they have some responsibility for it.
Ellen Weintraub from the Federal Election Commission, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews.
Salma Hayek, she's got these crazy fake teeth on, a crazy wig, crazy contacts. She is in this like menacing camp mode that I was like, whatever you're doing, I'm into it. There needs to be more of it. She was sort of like a Tilda Swinton character in like a Bong Joon-ho movie.
But is that enough to go see Like a Boss? We'll tell you next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, new year, and that means new movies. It also means bad movies, because we're in January. Joining us now, Alonzo Duralde, film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Hello.
Hello.
Also joining us, Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Hey there.
Hi.
All right, it's not all bad. But
not all bad.
Let's start with one that is.
Oh, yeah.
Like a Boss. It's a comedy starring Tiffany Haddish, Rose Byrne, and Selma Hayek. Walk
into the room. Mel Page and Mia Carter.
I'm Clara Luna.
I am going to invest $1.7 million on you.
We would love $1 million.
But in my experience, business and friendship don't always mix.
You don't have to worry, your pretty little head.
My head is not little. It's just that my breasts are humongous.
Okay, hi, Katie.
Highbrow, very highbrow.
We'll go to the female critic for this first.
Watching this movie felt like reading like just the answers of a Mad Libs. Like Tiffany Haddish, Rose Byrne, Salma Hayek, cosmetics, friendship, corporate takeover. Just you fill in the rest.
Right.
Because I swear there are many scenes missing from this movie.
What is it about?
It is about two friends who have been lifelong best friends. They're sort of life partners.
This is
Mel
Tiffany Haddish
and Mia.
And
yes.
Rose
and Tiffany. And And they have been there for each other through parental issues, through loss and, you know, devastation. And they've created this sort of small business, friendship oriented, very like empowering makeup brand. And that Clara Luna, played by Salma Hayek, she comes in as this like corporate takeover, trying to buy them. And she's, you know, got her own friendship issues in the past. And she's like, they're going to break up, you know. So it is incomprehensible from scene to scene. You're just like, what happened in that scene? There's something is missing. What also is incomprehensible to me is that Miguel Arteta, who is a great director, directed this. And
what did he do in the past?
Chuck and Buck.
And, he did Beatrice at Dinner.
Star Maps.
With Salma Hayek.
Yes, with Salma Hayek. Yes.
But he also did Alexander and the No Good, Very Bad, Terrible Day. Like he has a foot in studio, like I'll take the gig movies.
I don't begrudge anyone a studio paycheck. And if it allows him to do more great indies, then like that's amazing. But his imprint is nowhere to be found on this movie. And I just found it so befuddling.
It is weird that a movie that is so much about female friendships and about powerful women who use feminist rhetoric to hide a vicious agenda is being written and directed by men. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you're right, the movie doesn't make any sense. And I laughed a lot along the way, but I could tell it wasn't a good movie. Like, there's no structure to it. The plot doesn't go anywhere. There's all this character stuff that is revealed in dialogue at the end that we haven't seen, you know, manifest along the way. And so, like, there are plenty of chuckles, but it's a hot mess. And then the deeper idea about what it wants to say about women and women's relationships, I don't necessarily trust to the people who did it. Not that men can't and haven't written interesting films about women, but this one is not one.
Well, it copies the climax of I Feel Pretty, which, you know, where they crash a makeup launch and say, you know, makeup is not about looking different, it's about being yourself, and it couches like this empowerment message in like consumerism, which I always find very weird and problematic. So it's not.
And then the
good.
Whole obsession with her, with Selma Hayek's body.
Yeah, there's a lot of like jokes about body parts and body functions, and I do have to say that Selma Hayek, she has got these crazy fake teeth on, a crazy wig, crazy contacts. She is in this like menacing camp mode that I was like, whatever you're doing, I'm into it. There needs to be more of it. She was sort of like a Tilda Swinton character in like a Bong Joon-ho movie. Like, I was like, more Clara Luna.
And this is a movie that really kind of wastes a lot of really great, hilarious character actors.
Yeah.
Like, Billy Porter gets a couple of scenes to be funny, but for the most part is sort of standing there. They don't know what to do with Jennifer Coolidge, which is a high crime and misdemeanor. You know, Jessica St. Clair, like a deep bench of funny people who only occasionally get to be funny, and even when they are, it's still kind of a fleeting gag, but not in the service of anything. The one thing I will give this movie as far as, like, I think an interesting portrayal of women is that they very decidedly do not present love interests for either of the lead characters.
Like, not even each other?
No, this is a bromance for girls, basically. Yeah. They are each other's sort of hetero life partner, like they used to say about Jay and Silent Bob. And so the fact that the movie doesn't feel like that they have to have a third act boyfriend / husband to really, you know, give their lives meaning, that's a nice touch.
Yeah.
Moving on. Underwater, drama starring Kristen Stewart, where she battles mysterious creatures underwater.
When you're underwater for months at a time, you lose all sense of day and night. And some things are just out of your control.
Do you really think that was an earthquake?
No. We drilled to the bottom of the ocean, and we don't know what came out.
Okay, Alonzo, what is this movie about?
So this energy company is drilling at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, so like as deep as you can get in the ocean, and everyone is, you know, in this facility down at the bottom of the sea, and what appears to be an earthquake happens, or is it something else? And so, you know, it basically becomes a monster movie. This is a film that, you know, its makers have seen a lot of James Cameron, because there's a lot of aliens in this movie, there's a lot of abyss in this movie. It's mostly, if not entirely, recycled ideas. However, I think, you know, with a movie, you have to at least sort of give them credit for doing something with the stolen goods. And as a lean and mean, under 90 minutes, B-movie genre piece with a really fun Kristen Stewart performance, you know, it's at least got that going for
it. Does it have good jump scares or anything like that?
There's a, some, I would say.
Yeah, there's a couple. Yeah, I mean, this movie I like to call Alien Under the Sea.
Yes, wet alien.
Yeah, it's very damp because as soon as you see Kristen Stewart, she's got the shaved head, she's in her skivvies, you're like, this is her Ripley moment.
Totally.
Definitely.
And I love seeing Kristen Stewart in Ripley mode, and I love seeing her be a movie star. Like, for the past couple years, she's been like, hey, I'm a great actress. Remember that, guys. And I love seeing her be a great actress, but she's also a movie star. So watching her go into that mode was really fun for me. But it follows those beats that we know so well that you almost can predict the jump scares. You're like, and this person's going to, you know, get
There's like five or six people, you know, they're not all going to make it.
Right.
And you can practically, yeah, predict like in what order.
Like the crotchety sea captain.
They're going to get picked off.
He's going to go.
Is Vincent Cassell.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Lovecraftian, like cosmic horror. And I love watching Kristen Stewart in this. It does get a little kind of like murky and muddy there for a while. Like you're like, I can't see anything. They're at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, it's dark and like there's a lot of close-ups. And so you don't get that action movie sense of like, where is everybody in relation to everybody else? And where is the big monster thing in relation to everybody else? Or even how tall is the monster thing? I need something.
Do you ever see the monster thing?
Oh, you do. Yeah. But you're not, it's not really standing next to anything to provide you with enough perspective as to how
it's
large
really
it is.
It's really 2 inches tall.
Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I'm not mad at this movie, but it's a bit of an eye roll. Like, there's nothing in it you haven't seen before.
I think it's elevated by Kristen Stewart.
Absolutely.
And it's elevated by, I think it's shot really well and sort of edited in a cool way. So it's like cool style, great lead performance, but it's totally a B movie.
Well, it is January.
Yep, it is.
It is.
All right, let's
indeed
keep reminding ourselves. All right, finally, Les Miserables, not the musical. This is a feature inspired by riots in Paris more than 10 years ago. And we're not going to play a clip since it's in French, but this is set in the banlieue, the suburbs of Paris, mm-hmm. where a lot of immigrants live and live in big housing projects.
Yeah. This is France's Oscar submission, and it is directed by a guy named Lodge Lee, who is from Mali. And it's a sort of a day in a life of these three police officers. One new guy is sort of joining these other two and sort of learning the neighborhood, which is, you know, as you say, filled with immigrants and largely Muslim immigrants and African Muslim immigrants. It gives you a slice of life of what's happening in this neighborhood. It's a wild film. And there's like one moment sort of 2/3 of the way through where we take a breath.
Yeah.
And that was the moment where everything sort of landed for me, like the emotional trauma that the cops have been through, that the kids have been through, that the neighborhood guys have been through. And it's sort of, you know, this little escalations that lead into this explosion. It's a really remarkable film. The ending gets wild and crazy.
Yeah.
The film is sort of inspired by Victor Hugo and the idea that it's about the circumstances and the places around you that make people do what they do, not, you know, not that people are bad inherently.
Right. That it's about poverty and it's about, you know, other sort of social conditions. And yeah, I mean, the film even specifically references the 2005 riots in France in a way to sort of suggest, like, on the one hand, this is what the oppressed have. This is their only sort of tool to kind of express their discontent, to try and make change, to sort of, you know, stick it to the classes that are crushing them. And on the same time, kind of acknowledging, and this is probably not going to work out well. You're not necessarily going to come out with anything else on the other end of it, which is depressing. But, you know, the movie doesn't have any, I don't think fosters any illusions about like what comes out on the other end of that stuff, but at least it explores why it happens and what drives people to that point. Sometimes it's a big event or a shocking moment of violence, but oftentimes it's just, you know, what the kids call microaggressions, you know, just this steady thing of being hassled by the police, being treated like criminals, even if you're not one, just because of, you know, what you look like or where you live. And so, you know, eventually those things reach a boiling point.
That you can see where on Amazon?
I know it's in theaters.
It's in theaters, yeah. It's being distributed by Amazon, so it should be available.
It will eventually wind up on Prime, but at the moment it is it's theatrical only.
Okay. Well, speaking of online, let's say you don't want to go out to the movies. Any recommendations?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Oh, I've got one. Hulu has a couple of things that I would very highly recommend. One of them is Diane, the film starring Mary Kay Place, which LA Film Critics is presenting her with the Best Actress Award this weekend. Oscar nominations come out Monday. It is my furthest flung hope that she somehow makes it into the final five, but it's a small film from a small distributor, and I doubt that a lot of Academy voters saw it, but you can watch it on Hulu. It's great. And also on Hulu is a 1988 film that won Barbara Hershey Best Actress at Cannes called Shy People that has been rather difficult to access in this country, and it's now available on Hulu.
Oh, well, thank you for those.
My streaming recommendation is a series on Netflix called Cheer, which is about a cheerleading team, the best cheerleading team in the nation, college cheerleading. It is terrifying body horror. You watch this movie just like, I mean, this series just like, oh my God, when they do the pyramid, it is terrifying.
You see how
scary and challenging and what incredible athletes these cheerleaders are. And it's definitely not Bring It On. It is dark. Every kid is like, I would be in jail if I wasn't on the cheerleading team. So it's dark. It's socially realist. It is intense. You got to watch Cheer on Netflix.
Cool.
And that's feature. That's a feature. It's not.
It's a docuseries.
Oh, it's a docuseries.
Yeah.
So this is real.
Yeah. There's like five or six episodes, maybe. It's good.
Okay. Cheer.
Yeah. Be careful. You're gonna just be like, oh, I gotta go to the chiropractor or something.
Why do my knees hurt? I'm just sitting here.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the safest place to be.
Watching them hit the mat
on your couch.
The scariest thing I've seen in a long time.
Oof.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm already cringing.
I know.
Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Anna Alonzo Duraldi is film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, sports with a single Sklar brother next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW, and it's time for this.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Sports. Yes, sports. We haven't done sports in a while with the Sklar brothers. Well, and we're just going to do it with one Sklar brother, which is all we need at this moment. Hi, Jason.
I'm a whole person. I'm half of a duo, but I'm so happy to talk about a little bit of a distraction
happy
sports.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Okay, lots of football.
Football is big right now. NFL, we're in the playoffs. Just to let people know, if you don't know, this weekend are the division championship games. That means there are eight teams left, four games. Next weekend will be the conference championships, AFC and NFC, week off, and then the Super Bowl, and then the Oscars a week later. If you're a huge sports fan.
Which is my Super Bowl.
If you're a betting fan, yes, that is your Super Bowl. But it's very exciting because, you know, some of the best teams are still in it right now. Baltimore, the Ravens, they're a team that, you know, has really had an amazing year. And what's kind of interesting as we talk about this is who's not there right now. And that's Tom Brady, last year's Super Bowl champion. The Patriots didn't make it past the first round of the playoffs last weekend. Mm-hmm. And he has to sit at home, you know, in his, I'm going to guess, meager home.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a shack.
Eating his strange food and smoothies and watch the playoffs. And what's so interesting is that's not insignificant. There's something to the fact that there's almost a changing of the guard in the type of quarterback that is in the NFL. Now, Tom Brady was just a drop back quarterback, what they say, a pro style quarterback, which they might have to change that moniker. He would just drop back in the pocket and pass the ball all around the field. But now, because of the fact that there are new rules in the NFL protecting the quarterback, that you can't hit the quarterback really above the shoulders. Once the quarterback goes into a slide, you're not allowed to touch him. You know, there are a lot of new rules in the NFL that are protecting quarterbacks. So now quarterbacks who are run quarterbacks, who are dual threat quarterbacks, who can run as well as pass, those guys are lasting longer. They're not getting injured more. And they're becoming the premier quarterbacks in the league. So the quarterback for the Ravens is a young guy, Lamar Jackson, who many people, he came out of Louisville, many people said, you're going to have to be a wide receiver in the NFL. You're not a traditional quarterback. Well, guess what? He's leading the best team right
now. Because he's good at running?
Because he puts a lot of pressure on defenses that Tom Brady and quarterbacks like Tom Brady, like Drew Brees, who was the quarterback in the New Orleans Saints, they're no longer in it either. So you got guys like Russell Wilson, who's the quarterback for Seattle. He is a dual threat quarterback. You've got Pat Mahomes, who's a quarterback for Kansas City. He's a dual threat quarterback. Those guys and those teams are still in the playoffs, and that's what's kind of exciting. We're seeing almost a changing of the guard in the quarterback position in these playoffs right now.
Well, the reason why we're talking about Tom Brady, perhaps in the past tense, is that he's a free agent.
And some people are saying there are rumblings that he, first of all, he put his house up for sale.
Really?
So they're in New England. So there are rumblings, and people are saying, well, maybe
he'll
come.
Seems like a pretty big hint.
Come to Southern California, play for the Chargers. Maybe, you know, the Rams have their quarterback. The Chargers have Philip Rivers is a guy who's been in the league for a long time. You know, maybe it's his time to hang him up. Maybe Tom wants to come out west and, you know, head off into the sunset in his playing career out here in Southern California.
He could join the Royals.
The Royals.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
Those Royals, yes, not the Kansas City Royals. Yes, you are correct.
You know where my head is.
I know where your head is. I was like, that's not a sports reference I recognize. But it's interesting to think about Tom Brady's career, and he is the best. He is the greatest of all time. But what we're seeing right now is sort of with these sweeping rule changes that are protecting quarterbacks in a way that they didn't in the past, we're seeing a new breed, a new type of quarterback.
That's really interesting.
It's fascinating, and it's exciting to watch. So Baltimore, they're playing Tennessee this weekend. Tennessee's the sixth seed, and Baltimore's the number one seed. Tennessee has the rushing champion, the guy who gained the most yards from scrimmage, running back. He's a big dude. He's a load. Derrick Henry, he's like 6'4", 250 pounds. He looks like a linebacker, and he's very hard to take down. And some people say he's so good, even though Baltimore's run defense is so good, Derrick Henry is so good that he may neutralize this game. That's going to be an exciting game. You got the Packers and the Seahawks, Seattle coming to Green Bay. It's going to be freezing in
Green
Bay.
Speaking of Seattle, Marshawn Lynch.
He's back. Beast mode.
Again?
Yes, he goes beast mode. As we know, our biggest thing is that we want Diane Wiest to go Wiest mode in some of her movies. But Marshawn Lynch's beast mode is where he just runs over people. Seattle going to Green Bay. You got Aaron Rodgers, one of the best quarterbacks. He's kind of a bit of a dual threat because he can stand in the pocket and throw, but he can also get on his horse and run as well. That's going to be an exciting game. Minnesota Vikings upset the New Orleans Saints, and they're still in it. They got to play San Francisco. San Francisco, the 49ers, they haven't been in it for a few years, since 2015. So there are a lot of exciting storylines, cities
Who
that haven't been
do
there.
Do you think is going to make it all the way?
If I had to make a prediction, I would say I think Baltimore is the most balanced team. And I think if Lamar Jackson can stay healthy, I think that is the team to beat in the AFC. And I think in the NFC, this is going to be somewhat of an upset. But I think a team like Seattle, with Russell Wilson, he's just so unpredictable, and he can take the game on his own shoulders. I think you might be seeing a Seattle-Baltimore Super Bowl, which would be exciting and fantastic.
Okay. Well, we're going to hold you to that.
Hold me to that, please.
College football.
We've got the national championship
Monday.
Game. Yeah, which is between last year's champion, the Clemson Tigers, and this year's sort of favorite, the LSU Tigers. So I'm going to make a bold prediction. The Tigers are going to win. But I do think that, you know, college football in light of the NFL playoffs kind of takes a back seat.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say this is a game you should watch on Monday night because there's going to be a lot of offense. There's going to be a lot of excitement. It's going to be played in New Orleans. So LSU, a team that hasn't been there in a long time, you know, Clemson's been there for the last 5 years in the national championship game. LSU hasn't been in the national championship game since they've started doing this playoff. So there will be a lot of LSU fans there. It'll almost be like a home game in New Orleans. It's going to be very, very exciting. That's Monday night.
Okay, Monday night, we know where you're going to be.
Yes, I'll be glued to the TV.
And quickly, basketball, Lakers doing well this year.
So LeBron James was with the Lakers last year and was injured a lot, and the Lakers were not so good. Then they add one guy, Anthony Davis, from the New Orleans Pelicans, and this guy is one of the premier players in the league, and he and LeBron's healthy, he's back, and now they're the best team in the West, and they have the best record in the
injured,
West.
But he's injured, right?
Yes, Anthony Davis is injured briefly. However, this is middle of the season. I'm talking like as we look towards the end of the season. Right now they're in first place, but I think as we move forward towards the end of the season, you will see the Lakers will be right there at the top. The Clippers are in third or fourth place right now. A lot of the teams are close together. The Clippers might have an even more balanced team when you think about it. They have Kawhi Leonard. They have Paul George. But they also have a cast of supporting guys, Montrezl Harrell. And they have guys like Lou Williams, who off the bench scores 30 points. Some people are saying the Clippers are better positioned in the playoffs than even the Lakers. So if you're an L.A. basketball fan, you have one of two choices in this city of teams that are exciting and teams that I think are going to go very far in the playoffs this year.
It's good to be in L.A.
It's good to be in L.A., just like the Royals, not the Kansas City Royals. The other Royals.
Everyone wants to come here.
Of course.
Jason Sklar, one half of the Sklar brothers. The better half.
Thank you.
Check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And that's it for us for Press Play this week. Our producers are Alex Trigvadotter, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Kaylee Wells, and Rebecca Mooney. Michelle Aloy is our line editor, Amy Ta, our digital producer. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Mike Stark also engineered this week. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.